Disc 6.
Chapter 20. Rome. Posner arrived at the safe flat at 8 o'clock the next morning. He was a squat and powerfully built man, with hair like steel wool and acne scars on his broad cheeks. Judging from his unshaven face and the red rims around his eyes, it was a safe assumption that he had not slept. Wordlessly, he poured himself a cup of coffee and dropped the morning newspapers on the kitchen table. The shootout in San Lorenzo Quarter was the lead of each paper. Gabriel, still groggy from the painkillers, looked down at them but was powerless to summon an expression.
"You made quite a mess in my town."
Posner tipped half a cup of coffee down his throat and pulled a face.
"Imagine my surprise when I get the flash that the great Gabriel Allon is on the run and needs to be pulled in. You'd think someone at King Saul Boulevard would have the common sense to inform the local station chief when Gabriel Allon is in town to take someone down."
"I didn't come to Rome to take anyone down."
"Bullshit," Posner snapped. "That's what you do."
Posner looked up as Chiara entered the kitchen. She wore a toweling robe. Her hair, still wet from the shower, was combed straight back. She poured herself some coffee and sat down next to Gabriel at the table. Posner said,
"Do you know what's going to happen if the Italians ever figure out who you are? It will destroy our relationship. They'll never work with us again."
"I know," Gabriel said, "but I didn't come here to kill anyone. They tried to kill me." Posner pulled out a chair and sat down, his thick forearms resting on the table.
"What were you doing in Rome, Gabriel? And don't bullshit me."
When Gabriel informed Posner that he was in Rome on a job for Shamron, the station chief tilted his round head back and emptied his lungs toward the ceiling.
"Shamron! That's why no one at King Saul Boulevard knows what you're working on. For Christ's sake, I should have known the old man was behind this."
Gabriel pushed away the newspapers. He supposed he did owe Posner an explanation. It had been reckless to come to Rome after the murder of Peter Malone. He'd underestimated the capabilities of his enemies and left Posner with a colossal mess to clean up. He drank a cup of coffee to clear his head and told Posner the story from the beginning. Chiara's gaze remained fixed on him the entire time. Posner managed to remain calm for the first half of Gabriel's account, but by the end of the story he was smoking nervously.
"Sounds as if they were following Rossi," Posner said, "and Rossi led them to you."
"He seemed to know he was under surveillance. He never left the window while he was in my room. He saw them coming for us, but it was too late."
"Was there anything in that room that could link you to the office?"
Gabriel shook his head, then asked Posner whether he'd ever heard of a group called Crux Vera.
"One hears all sorts of rumors about secret societies and Vatican intrigue in Italy," Posner said. "Remember the P2 scandal back in the 80s?
Vaguely, thought Gabriel. Quite by chance, the Italian police had come across a document revealing the existence of a secret right-wing society that had wormed its way into the highest reaches of the government, military, and intelligence community. And the Vatican, apparently.
"I've heard the name Crux Vera,"
Posner continued, "but I've never put much stock into it. Until now, that is." "When do I get to leave?"
"We'll move you tonight."
"Where?" Posner inclined his head toward the east, and by the look of finality in his dark eyes, it was clear to Gabriel that he was referring to Israel.
"I don't want to go to Israel. I want to find out who killed Benjamin." "You can't move anywhere in Europe now. You're blown. You're going home. Period. Shamron isn't the chief anymore. Lev is the chief, and he's not going to be brought down by one of the old man's adventures."
"How are you going to get me out of the country?"
"The same way we got Vanunu out. By boat."
"If I remember correctly, that was one of Shamron's adventures too." Mordecai Vanunu had been a disgruntled worker at the Dimona Atomic Facility, who revealed the existence of Israel's nuclear arsenal to a London newspaper. A female agent named Cheryl Bentov lured Vanunu from London to Rome, where he was kidnapped and taken by small boat to an Israeli naval vessel lying in wait off the Italian coast. Few people outside the office knew the truth about the episode, that Vanunu's defection and betrayal of Israeli secrets had been choreographed and manipulated by Ari Shamron,
as a way to warn Israel's enemies that they had no hope of ever bridging the nuclear gap, while at the same time leaving Israel with the ability to deny publicly that it possessed nuclear weapons. Vanunu left Italy in chains and under heavy sedation. Pazner said, "You'll be spared that indignity as long as you behave yourself." "Where do we set sail?" "There's a beach near Fiumicino that's perfect. You'll take a motor launch from there at 9 o'clock. 5 miles offshore you'll meet an ocean-going motor yacht, crew of one. He's office now, but for many years he captained a Navy gunboat. He'll take you back to Tel Aviv. A few days at sea will be good for you."
"Who's taking me to the yacht?"
Pazna looked at Chiara. "She grew up in Venice. She's damned good with a boat."
"She does handle a motorcycle well," Gabriel said.
Pazna leaned forward across the table. "You should see her with a Beretta."
Eric Langer arrived at Fiumicino Airport at 9 o'clock that morning. After clearing customs and passport control, he spotted Rashid Husseini's man standing in the terminal hall, clutching a brown cardboard sign that read, "Trans-Euro Technologies, Mr. Bowman." He had a car waiting outside in the covered parking lot, a battered beige Lancia that he piloted with unwarranted caution. He called himself Aziz and spoke English with a faint British accent. Like Husseini, he had the air of an academic. He drove to a faded apartment house at the base of the Aventine Hill and led Langer up a crumbling staircase that spiraled upward into the gloom. The flat was empty of furniture except for a television connected to a satellite dish on the tiny balcony. Aziz gave Langer a gun, a Makarov 9mm with a silencer screwed into the barrel, then brewed Turkish coffee in the galley kitchen. They spent the next 3 hours sitting cross-legged on the floor, like Bedouins, drinking coffee and watching the war in the territories on Al Jazeera television. The Palestinian chain-smoked American cigarettes. With each televised outrage, he let loose a string of Arabic curses. At 2 in the afternoon, he went downstairs to fetch bread and cheese from the grocer. He returned to discover Langer enthralled by a cooking program on an American cable channel. He brewed more coffee and changed the channel back to Al Jazeera without asking Langer's permission. Langer ate a bit of lunch, then made a pillow of his overcoat and stretched out on the bare floor for a nap. He was awakened by the purr of Aziz's cellular telephone. He opened his eyes to find the Arab listening intently and scribbling a note on a paper sack. Aziz rang off, and his gaze was drawn back to the television. An anchorman was offering breathless narration to a piece of video depicting Israeli soldiers firing into a crowd of Palestinian boys. Aziz lit another cigarette and looked at Langer. "Let's go kill the bastard." By sunset, Gabriel's wound hurt less, and his appetite had returned. Chiara cooked fettuccine with mushrooms and cream, and they watched the evening news. The first 10 minutes of the broadcast was devoted to the search for the papal assassin. Over video of heavily armed Italian security forces patrolling the nation's airports and borders, the correspondent described it as one of the largest manhunts in Italian history. When Gabriel's photograph appeared on the screen, Chiara squeezed his hand. After supper, she put a clean dressing on his wound and gave him another shot of antibiotics. When she offered Gabriel something for the pain, he refused. At 6:30, they changed clothes. The forecast was for rain and rough seas, and they dressed appropriately. Fleece underwear, waterproof outerwear, rubber boots over insulated socks. Pazna had left Gabriel a false Canadian passport and a Beretta 9mm. Gabriel hid the passport in a zippered compartment of his coat and slipped the Beretta into a patch pocket within easy reach. Pazna arrived at 6 o'clock. His thick face was set in a furrowed scowl, and his movements were crisp and precise. Over a last cup of coffee, he calmly briefed them. Getting out of Rome would be the most dangerous part of the escape, he explained. The police had mounted rolling checkpoints and were making random stops all over the city. His businesslike demeanor helped to settle Gabriel's nerves. At 7 o'clock, they left the flat. Pazna made a point of speaking a few words in excellent Italian during the descent down the staircase. Parked in the courtyard was a dark gray Volkswagen delivery van. Pazna climbed into the front passenger seat.
Gabriel and Chiara clambered through the side door into the cargo hold. The floor was cold to the touch. The driver started the engine and switched on the wipers. He wore a blue anorak, and the pale hands gripping the steering wheel were the hands of a pianist. Pazna called him Ruven. The van jerked forward and passed through the arched entrance of the courtyard, then turned right and accelerated into traffic. Sprawled on the floor of the van, Gabriel could see nothing but the night sky and the reflections of passing headlights. He knew they were heading west. To avoid the checkpoints on Rome's main thoroughfares and the Autostrada, Pazna had charted a course to the sea, consisting of side streets and back roads. Gabriel looked towards Chiara and found that she was staring at him. He tried to hold her gaze, but she looked away. He leaned his head against the wall and closed his eyes. Aziz had brought Langer up to date during the brief drive from the Aventine Hill to the old palazzo high atop the Janiculum. For several years, Palestinian intelligence had been aware that Shimon Pazna was an agent of the Israeli Secret Service. They had followed him from posting to posting, charted the course of his career. In Rome, where he was assumed to be the chief of station, he was under regular surveillance. Twice that day, once in the early morning and again in the late afternoon, Pazna had visited a flat in a converted palazzo on the Janiculum. PLO intelligence had long suspected that the property was an Israeli safe flat. The case was circumstantial, the connections tenuous, but given the circumstances, the chances seemed reasonable that Gabriel Allon, the killer of Abu Jihad, was inside. Parked on the street 100 meters from the entrance of the old palazzo, Langer and Aziz had watched and waited. There were lights burning in only two of the flats facing the street, one on the second floor and the other on the top. In that flat, the shades were tightly drawn. Langer took note of the arriving tenants. A pair of boys on a motorino, a woman in a miniature two-seater Fiat, a middle-aged man in a belted raincoat who came by way of a city bus, a dark grey Volkswagen delivery van, one man in the front, dressed in a blue windbreaker, that turned into the central courtyard. Langer consulted his watch. 10 minutes later, the van poked from the entrance of the courtyard and turned into the street. As it sped past their position, Langer noticed that there was now a second man in the front seat. He spurred Aziz into action with a sharp elbow to the ribs. The Palestinian started the engine, waited a decent interval, and then swung a U-turn and followed after the van. 5 minutes after leaving the safe flat, Shimon Pazna's cellular phone rang. He had taken the precaution of a chase car, a second team of agents whose job it was to make certain that the van was not being followed. A call from the team at this stage could mean one of two things: no sign of surveillance, proceed to the beach as scheduled, or trouble, take evasive action. Pazna pressed the call button and raised the phone to his ear. He listened in silence for a moment, then murmured, "Take them out the first chance you get." He punched the end button and looked at the driver. "We've got company, Ruven. Beige Lancia, two cars back." The driver put his foot to the floor, and the van shot forward. Gabriel reached into his pocket and wrapped his hand around the comforting shape of the Beretta. For Langer, the rapid acceleration of the van provided confirmation that Gabriel Allon was inside. It also meant that they had been spotted, that the element of surprise had been lost, and that killing Allon would entail a high-speed chase followed by a shootout, something that violated nearly all of Langer's operational tenets. He killed by stealth and surprise, appearing where he was least expected and slipping quietly away. Gun battles were for commandos and desperados, not professional assassins. Still, he was loath to let Allon escape so easily. Reluctantly, he ordered Aziz to take up the chase. The Palestinian downshifted and pressed hard on the accelerator, trying to maintain contact. 2 minutes later, the interior of the Lancia was suddenly filled with blinding halogen light. Langer shot a look over his shoulder and saw the distinctive headlights of a Mercedes a few inches from the rear bumper. The Mercedes moved left, so that its right front bumper was aligned with the left rear bumper of the Lancia. Langer braced himself against the dash. The Mercedes accelerated hard, closing the gap between the two cars. The Lancia shuddered with the impact, then went into a violent clockwise spin. Aziz shouted and clung desperately to the wheel. Lange grabbed the armrest and waited for the car to roll. It never did. After what seemed like an eternity, the Lancia came to a stop, facing the opposite direction. Lange turned around and glanced through the rear window, in time to see the van and the Mercedes disappear below the crest of a hill. 90 minutes later, the van rolled to a stop in a car park, overlooking a wind-swept beach. The labored howl of a jumbo jet, sinking out of the black sky, provided proof that they were near the end of Fiumicino's busy runway. Chiara climbed out and walked down to the water's edge to see if it was clear. The van shuddered in the wind gusts. 2 minutes later, she poked her head through the doors and nodded. Pasner shook Gabriel's hand and wished him luck. Then he looked at Chiara. "We'll wait here. Hurry." Gabriel followed her along the rocky beach. They came to the boat, a 10-foot Zodiac, and dragged it into the frigid surf. The engine started without hesitation. Chiara guided the boat expertly out to sea, the stubby prow bucking over the wind-driven surf, while Gabriel watched the shoreline falling away and the coastal lights growing dim. Italy, a country he loved, a place that had given him peace after the Wrath of God operation. He wondered whether he would ever be allowed to go back again. Chiara removed a radio from her jacket pocket, murmured a few words into the microphone, and released the talk button. A moment later, the running lights of a motor yacht flickered on. "There," she said, pointing off the starboard side. "There's your ride home." She changed the heading and opened the throttle, racing across the white caps toward the waiting vessel. 50 yards from the yacht, she killed the engine and glided silently toward the stern. Then, for the first time, she looked at Gabriel.
"I'm coming with you."
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm coming with you,"
she repeated deliberately. "I'm going to Israel."
"No, you're not. You're going to Provence to find the daughter of Regina Carcassi, and I'm going with you."
"You're going to put me on that yacht, and then you're going to turn around.
Even with that Canadian passport, you can't go anywhere in Europe right now. You can't rent a car, you can't get on an airplane. You need me. And what if Pasner was lying? What if there are 2 men on that boat instead of just one?"
Gabriel had to admit she had a point. "You're a fool to do this, Chiara. You'll destroy your career."
"No, I won't," she said. "I'll tell them that you forced me to accompany you against my will."
Gabriel looked up at the motor yacht. It was growing larger by degrees. Honor was due. Chiara had picked the perfect time to spring her trap.
"Why?"
he asked. "Why do you want to do this?"
"Did my father tell you that his grandparents were among the elderly Jews who were removed from that home in the ghetto and deported to Auschwitz? Did he tell you that they died there, along with all the others?"
"He didn't mention that."
"Do you know why he didn't tell you? Because even now, even after all these years, he can't bring himself to speak of it. He can recite the name of every Venetian Jew who died at Auschwitz, but he can't bring himself to talk about his own grandparents."
She removed a beretta from her jacket pocket and pulled the slide.
"I'm coming with you to find that woman."
The Zodiac nudged against the stern of the motor yacht. Above them, a figure appeared on the deck and looked over the railing at them. Gabriel tied off the line and held the boat steady, while Chiara pulled herself up the ladder. Then he followed after her. By the time he reached the deck, the captain was standing with his arms in the air and a look of utter disbelief on his face.
"Sorry," Gabriel said. "I'm afraid there's been a slight change in our itinerary."
Chiara had brought a syringe and a bottle of sedative. Gabriel led the captain down to one of the staterooms below deck and bound his wrists and ankles with a length of line. The man struggled for a few seconds as Chiara pulled up his sleeve, but when Gabriel pressed his forearm against the man's throat, he relaxed and allowed Chiara to give him the injection. When he was unconscious, Gabriel checked the knots, tight enough to hold him, not tight enough to cut off the circulation to his hands and feet. "How long is the sedative supposed to last?"
10 hours, but he's big. I'll give him another dose in 8.
"Just don't kill the poor bastard. He's on our side."
"He'll be fine."
Chiara led the way up to the bridge. A chart of the waters off Italy's western coast
was spread on the table. She checked their position on the GPS display and quickly plotted a course. Then she powered up the engines and brought the yacht around to a proper heading. A moment later they were cruising north, toward the straits between Elba and Corsica. She turned and looked at Gabriel, who was watching in admiration, and said, "We're going to need some coffee. Think you can handle that?"
"I'll do my best."
"Sometime tonight would be good."
"Yes, sir."
Shimon Pasner stood motionless on the beach, hands on his hips, shoes filled with seawater, trousers soaked to the knee, like a long submerged statue being slowly revealed by the receding waters. He brought his radio to his lips and tried to raise Kiara one last time. Silence. She should have been back an hour ago. There were two possibilities, neither pleasant. Possibility one, something had gone wrong, and they were lost. Possibility two, allons. Pasner hurled his radio into the surf in disgust, a look of pure loathing on his face, and trod slowly back to the van. There was just enough time for Eric Langer to catch the night train for Zurich. He directed Aziz to a quiet side street adjacent to the rail lines feeding out of the Stazioni Termini and told him to shut down the engine. Aziz seemed puzzled. "Why do you want to be dropped here?" "At the very moment, every police officer in Rome is looking for Gabriel Allon. Surely they're watching the train stations and airports. It's best not to show your face there, unless it's absolutely necessary." The Palestinian seemed to accept this explanation. Langer could see a train easing out of the station. He waited patiently to take his leave. "Tell Hussein that I'll contact him in Paris when things have cooled down," Langer said. "I'm sorry we weren't successful tonight." Langer shrugged. "With a bit of luck, we'll get another chance." The train was suddenly next to them, filling the car with a metallic screeching. Langer saw his chance. He opened the door and stepped out of the car. Aziz leaned across the front seat and called out, but his words were drowned out by the sound of the train.
"What?"
Langer asked, cupping his ear.
"I can't hear you."
"The gun,"
Aziz repeated.
"You forgot to give me the gun."
"Ah, yes."
Langer removed the silent Stetchkin from his coat pocket and pointed it toward Aziz. The Palestinian reached out for it. The first shot pierced the palm of his hand before tearing into his chest cavity. The second left a neat circle above his right eye. Langer dropped the gun on the passenger seat and walked into the station. The Zurich train was boarding. He found his compartment in the first-class sleeper carriage and stretched out in the comfortable berth. 20 minutes later, as the train slipped through the northern suburbs of Rome, he closed his eyes and was immediately asleep. Chapter 21. Tiberias, Israel. The call from Lev did not awaken Shamron. Indeed, he had not closed his eyes since the first urgent flash from Rome that Gabriel and the girl were missing. He lay in bed, the telephone a few inches from his ear, listening to Lev's histrionics while Geula stirred softly in her sleep. The indignity of aging, he thought. Not long ago, Lev was a green recruit, and Shamron was the one who did the screaming. Now the old man had no choice but to hold his tongue and bide his time. When the tirade ended, the line went dead. Shamron swung his feet to the floor, pulled on a robe, and walked outside to his terrace, overlooking the lake. The sky in the east was beginning to turn pale blue with the coming dawn, but the sun had not yet appeared over the ridge of the hills. He dug through the pockets of the robe, looking for cigarettes, hoping against hope that Geula hadn't found them. It filled him with a sense of great personal victory when his stubby fingers came upon a crumpled packet. He lit one and savored the bite of the harsh Turkish tobacco on his tongue. Then he lifted his gaze and let it wander for a moment over the view. He never tired of it, this window on his private corner of the promised land. It was no accident the vista faced eastward. That way Shamron, the eternal sentinel, could keep watch on Israel's enemies. The air smelled of a coming storm. Soon the rains would arrive, and once more the land would run with flood water. How many more floods would he see? In his most pessimistic moments, Shamron wondered how many more the children of Israel would see. Like most Jews, he was gripped by an unwavering fear that his generation would be the last. A man much wiser than Shamron had called the Jews the ever-dying people, a people forever on the verge of ceasing to be. It had been Shamron's mission in life to rid his people of that fear, to wrap them in a blanket of security and make them feel safe. He was haunted by the realization that he had failed. He scowled at his stainless steel wristwatch. Gabriel and the girl had been missing for 8 hours. It was Shamron's affair, but it was blowing up in Lev's face. Gabriel was getting closer to identifying the killers of Benjamin Stern, but Lev wanted no part of it. Little Lev, thought Shamron derisively, the craven bureaucrat, a man whose innate sense of caution rivaled the daring and audacity of Shamron.
Do I need this, Ari?
Lev had screamed.
The Europeans are accusing us of behaving like Nazis in the territories, and now one of your old killers is accused of trying to assassinate the Pope? Tell me where I can find him. Help me bring him in before this thing destroys this beloved service of yours once and for all.
Perhaps Lev was right, though it pained Shamron to even consider such a thought. Israel had enough problems at the moment. The Shahids were turning markets into bloodbaths. The thief of Baghdad was still trying to forge his nuclear sword. Perhaps now was not the best time to pick a fight with the Roman Catholic Church. Perhaps now was not the best time to go wading in old waters. The water was dirty and filled with unseen hazards, potholes and rocks, hidden brush where a man could become entangled and drown. And then an image appeared in his thoughts. A muddy village outside Krakow. A rampaging crowd, shop windows smashed, homes set ablaze, men beaten bloody with clubs, women raped.
Christ killers, Jewish filth, kill the Jews!
A child's village, a young child's memories of Poland. The boy would be sent to Palestine to live with relatives on a settlement in the Upper Galilee. The parents would stay behind. The boy would join the Haganah and fight in Israel's war of rebirth. When the new state was putting together an intelligence service, the boy, now a young man, would be invited to join. In a shabby suburb north of Buenos Aires, he would become an almost mythical figure by seizing the throat of the man who had sent his parents and 6 million others to the camps of death. Shamron found that his eyes were squeezed tightly shut and that his hands were gripping the top of the balustrade. Slowly, finger by finger, he relaxed his grip. A line of Eliot ran through his head. In my beginning is my end. Eichmann. How had this puppeteer of death, this murdering bureaucrat who made the trains of genocide run on time, how had it come to pass that he was living quietly in a hard scrabble suburb of Buenos Aires when 6 million had perished? Shamron knew the answer, of course, for every page of the Eichmann file was engraved in his memory. Like hundreds of other murderers, he had escaped via the convent route, a chain of monasteries and church property stretching from Germany to the Italian port of Genoa. In Genoa, he had been given shelter by Franciscans, and, through the auspices of church charitable organizations, was provided with false papers describing him as a refugee. On June 14, 1950, he emerged from the shelter of the Franciscan convent long enough to board the Giovanna C, bound for Buenos Aires. Bound for a new life in the new world, thought Shamron. The leader of the church had not been able to find the words to condemn the murder of 6 million, but his bishops and priests had given comfort and sanctuary to the greatest mass killer in history. This was a fact that Shamron could never comprehend, a sin for which there was no absolution. He thought of Lev's voice screeching down the secure line from Tel Aviv. No, thought Shamron. I will not help Lev find Gabriel. Quite the opposite. He was going to help him discover what happened in that convent by the lake, and who killed Benjamin Stern. He walked back into the house, his step crisp and sure-footed, and went to his bedroom. Geula was lying in bed, watching television. Shamron packed a suitcase. Every few seconds, she would glance up from the screen and look at him, but she did not speak. It had been this way for more than 40 years. When his bag was packed, Shamron sat on the bed next to her and held her hand.
You'll be careful,
won't you, Ari?
Of course, my love.
You won't smoke cigarettes, will you?
Never.
Come home soon.
Soon,
Shyamalan said, and he kissed her forehead. There was an indignity to his visits to King Saul Boulevard that Shyamalan found deeply depressing. He had to sign the logbook at the security station in the lobby and attach a laminated tag to his shirt pocket. No longer could he use his old private elevator, that was reserved for Lev now. Instead, he crowded into an ordinary lift, filled with desk officers and boys and girls from the file rooms. He rode up to the fourth floor. His ritual humiliation did not end there, for Lev still had a few more ounces of flesh to extract. There was no one to bring him coffee, so he was forced to fend for himself in the canteen, coaxing a cup of weak brew from an automated machine. Then he walked down the hall to his office, a bare room not much larger than a storage closet with a pine table, a folding steel chair, and a chipped telephone that smelled of disinfectant. Shyamalan sat down, opened his briefcase, and removed the surveillance photograph from London, the one snapped by Mordecai outside Peter Malone's home. Shyamalan sat over it for several minutes, elbows on the table, knuckles pressed to his temples. Every few seconds, a head would poke around the edge of the door, and a pair of eyes would stare at him, as if he were some exotic beast. Yes, it's true. The old man is roaming the halls of headquarters once more. Shyamalan saw none of it. He had eyes only for the man in the photograph. Finally, he picked up the telephone and dialed the extension for research. It was answered by a girl who sounded as though she was barely out of high school.
This is Shyamalan.
Who?
Shyamalan, he said irritably. I need the file on the Cyprus kidnapping case. It was 1986, if I remember correctly. That's probably before you were born, but do your best.
He slammed down the phone and waited. 5 minutes later, a bleary-eyed boy called Yossi appeared in Shyamalan's ignoble door.
Sorry, boss, the girl is new.
He held up a bound file.
You wanted to see this?
Shyamalan held out his hand, like a beggar. It had not been one of Shyamalan's prouder moments. In the summer of 1986, Israeli Justice Minister Meir Ben David set sail from Tel Aviv for a 3-week Mediterranean cruise aboard a private yacht, along with 12 other guests and a crew of 5. On day 9 of their holiday in the harbor at Larnaca, the yacht was seized by a team of terrorists claiming to represent a group called the Fighting Palestinian Cells. A rescue attempt was ruled out, and the Cypriots wanted the messiness resolved as quickly and as quietly as possible. That left the Israeli government with no choice but to negotiate, and Shyamalan opened a channel of communication with the German-speaking team leader. 3 days later, the siege ended. The hostages were released, the terrorists were granted safe passage, and a month later, a dozen hardcore PLO killers were released from Israeli jails. Publicly, Israel denied there had been a quid pro quo, though no one believed it. For Shyamalan, it had been a bitter herb indeed, and now, flipping through the pages of the file, he relived it all again. He came to a photograph, the one image they had managed to capture of the team leader. It was useless, really. A long-distance shot, grainy and muddled, a face concealed behind sunglasses and a hat. He placed the picture beside the surveillance photograph from London, and spent several minutes comparing them. Same man? Impossible to tell. He picked up the phone and rang research again. This time Yossi answered.
Yes, boss.
Bring me the file on the leopard.
He was an enigma, an educated guess, a theory. Some said he was German, some said Austrian, some Swiss. One linguist who listened to the tapes of his conversations with Shyamalan, which were conducted in English, theorized that he was from the Alsace-Lorraine. It was the West Germans who had hung the code name Leopard on him. He had done a good deal of killing there, and they wanted him the most. A terrorist for hire. A man who would work for any group, any cause, as long as it conformed to his core beliefs. Communist, anti-Western, anti-Zionist. It was the Leopard who was believed to have been behind the hijacking in Cyprus, and the Leopard who had murdered 3 other Israelis in Europe on behalf of PLO commando Abu Jihad. Shyamalan had wanted him dead. His wish had gone unfulfilled. He leafed through the file, which was hopelessly thin. Here a report from the French service, here an Interpol dispatch, here a rumor of an alleged sighting in Istanbul. There were three photographs as well, though it was not clear whether any were really him. The shot from the yacht in Cyprus, a surveillance photo taken in Bucharest, another at Charles de Gaulle Airport. Shamron laid the photo from London next to them and looked up at Yossi, who was watching over his shoulder. "That one and that one, boss." Shamron pulled the Bucharest shot out of the lineup and laid it next to London. Same angle, head on, chin slightly to the left, obscuring half the face.
"I could be wrong, Yossi, but I think it's possible that these are the same men."
"Hard to say, boss, but the computer may be able to tell us for sure."
"Run them," Shamron said. Then he picked up the files. "I want to keep these."
"You have to sign a chit."
Shamron looked at Yossi over spectacles. Yossi said, "I'll sign the chit for you."
"Good boy."
Shamron reached for the telephone one last time and dialed travel. When he finished with his arrangements, he placed the files in his briefcase and headed downstairs.
"I'm coming, Gabriel," he thought, "but where in God's name are you?"
Chapter 22. The Mediterranean Sea. The rocks of Cap Corse appeared at dawn. Chiara guided the yacht around the tip of the island and set it on a northwesterly heading. A line of gunpowder clouds stood before them, swollen with rain. The winds had increased by several knots, and it was suddenly much colder.
"The Mistral," Chiara said. "It's blowing hard today. I'm afraid the rest of the trip isn't going to be so pleasant."
A ferry appeared off the port side, steaming out of L'Île Rousse toward the French coast.
"That one's going to Nice," she said. "We can follow his heading, then steer toward Cannes as we get closer to the coastline."
"How long?"
5 to 6 hours, maybe longer because of the Mistral. Take the wheel for a while. I'll go down to the galley and see if there's anything for breakfast."
"Make sure Sleeping Beauty is still with us."
"I will."
Breakfast consisted of coffee, toasted bread, and a lump of hard cheese. They barely had time to eat, because 30 minutes after rounding Cap Corse, the storm closed in. For the next 4 hours the boat was battered by a steady onslaught of wind-driven swells rolling out of the north, and sheets of rain that reduced visibility to less than 100 meters. At some point they lost track of the ferry. It was no matter. Chiara simply navigated by compass and GPS. The rain quit at noon, but the wind blew ceaselessly. It seemed to grow stronger as they drew closer to the coast. Behind the storm was a mass of bitterly cold air, and for the last hour of the journey the sun was in and out of the clouds, shining one minute, hidden the next. The color of the water changed with the sun, now gray-green, now deep blue. Finally, direct off the prow, Cannes. The distinctive line of gleaming white hotels and apartment houses along La Croisette. Chiara guided them away from the Croisette, toward the old port at the other end of town. In the summer season the promenades around the Vieux Port would be teeming with tourists, and the harbour jammed with luxury yachts. Now most of the restaurants were tightly shuttered, and there were plenty of berths available in the harbour. Chiara left Gabriel on the boat, and walked a few blocks to the Rue d'Antibes to rent a car. While she was away, Gabriel untied the hands and feet of the unconscious boat captain. Chiara had given him an injection 4 hours earlier, which meant he would remain unconscious for several more hours. Gabriel went back up to the deck and waited for Chiara. A few minutes later, a Peugeot hatchback pulled into a parking space on the Quai Saint-Pierre. Chiara stepped out of the car long enough to wave in Gabriel's direction and slide over into the passenger seat. Gabriel climbed down off the boat and got behind the wheel.
"Any problems?" he asked. She shook her head. "We need clothes."
"Ah, shopping on the Croisette. Just what I need after spending all night and half the day on the damned boat. I can't decide between Gucci and Versace."
"I was thinking of something a little more ordinary. Maybe one of those nice places along the Boulevard Carnot, where the real people go to buy their clothes."
"Oh, how pedestrian."
"Exactly."
Gabriel wound his way across the old town, and a few minutes later they were heading north up the Boulevard Carnot, the main thoroughfare linking the waterfront of Cannes to the inland towns. The Mistral was howling. A few brave souls were out, backs bent, hands on their hats. The air was filled with dust and paper. After a few blocks, Gabriel spotted a small department store next to a bus stop. Chiara frowned. He pulled into an empty parking space, gave her a wad of cash, and recited his sizes. Chiara climbed out and walked the rest of the way. Gabriel left the engine running and listened to the news. Still no sign of the suspected papal assassin. Italian police had stepped up security at the nation's airports and border crossings. He switched off the radio. Chiara emerged from the store 20 minutes later, a bulging plastic sack swinging from each hand. The wind was at her back, blowing her hair over her face. Because of the bags of clothing, she was defenseless to do anything about it. She tossed the bags into the back seat and got in. Gabriel headed up the Boulevard Carnot. 10 minutes later, he came to a large traffic circle and followed the signs for Grasse. A four-lane highway stretched before them, rising up the slope of the hill toward the base of the Maritime Alps. Chiara reclined the seat, pulled off her fleece shirt, and shimmied out of the heavy waterproof pants. Gabriel kept his eyes fastened on the road. She dug through the bags of clothing until she found the clean underwear and bra she had bought for herself.
"Don't look."
"I wouldn't dream of it."
"Really? Why not?"
"Just hurry up and get some clothing on, please."
"That's the first time a man has ever said that to me."
"I can see why." She swatted his arm and quickly changed into jeans, a sweater with a thick turtleneck, and fashionable black leather boots with square toes and thick heels. She looked very much like the attractive young woman he had seen for the first time in the ghetto in Venice. When she was finished, she sat up.
"Your turn. Pull over, and I'll drive while you change."
Gabriel did as she asked. From a purely fashion perspective, he did not fare as well. A pair of loose-fitting blue cotton trousers with an elastic waist, a thick wool fisherman's sweater, a pair of tan espadrilles that scratched his feet. He looked like a man who spent his days idling in the town square playing boule. "I look ridiculous."
"I think you look very handsome. More importantly, you can walk through any town in Provence, and no one will think you're anything but a local."
For 10 minutes, Chiara navigated the winding road through olive trees and eucalyptus. They came to the medieval town of Valbonne. Gabriel directed her northward, to a town called Opio, and from Opio to Le Rouret. She parked outside a tabac and waited in the car while Gabriel went inside. Behind the counter was a dark-complected man with tightly curled hair and Algerian features. When Gabriel asked whether he knew an Italian woman called Carcassi, the clerk shrugged his shoulders and suggested that Gabriel speak to Mark, the bartender next door at the Brasserie. Gabriel found Mark polishing glasses with a dirty towel. When he put the same question to him, the bartender shook his head. He knew of no one named Carcassi in the village, but there was an Italian woman who lived on the road that led to the entrance of the nature park. He tossed his towel over his shoulder and stepped outside to point Gabriel in the right direction. Gabriel thanked him and rejoined Chiara.
"That way," he said, "across the main road, past the gendarmerie, then up the hill."
The road was narrow, little more than a one-lane paved track, and the grade of the hill was steep. There were villas among the olive and pepper trees. Some were modest homes owned by locals. Others were opulent, well-tended, and shielded by hedges and high stone walls. The villa where the Italian woman purportedly lived fell into the second category. It was a stately old estate house with a turret rising above the main entrance. The garden was a terraced affair, surrounded by a stone wall. There was no name on the daunting iron gate. When Gabriel pressed the button on the intercom, dogs began to bark. A few seconds later, a pair of Belgian shepherds came galloping from the back of the villa, teeth bared, barking fanatically. They charged the gate and snapped at Gabriel through the bars. He took a quick step back and put a hand on the door latch of the car. He did not like dogs to begin with, and not long ago he'd had a run-in with an Alsatian that had left him with a broken arm and several dozen stitches. He inched forward cautiously so as not to further incite the dogs, and pressed the intercom button once again. This time he received a response, a woman's voice barely audible above the wild barking.
Oui?
Madame Carcassi.
My name is Hubernau. Carcassi was my maiden name.
Was your mother Regina Carcassi from Tolmezzo in the north of Italy? A moment's hesitation, then,
who is this, please?
The dogs, hearing the note of anxiety in their master's voice, began to bark even more ferociously. During the night, Gabriel had been unable to decide how to make his approach to the daughter of Regina Carcassi. Now, with the shepherds trying to tear his legs off, and a gale-force wind beating down on him from the Alps, he had little patience for subterfuge and cover stories. He reached out and pressed the button once more.
My name is Gabriel, he said, shouting over the commotion of the dogs. I work for the government of Israel. I believe I know who killed your mother, and I believe I know why.
There was no response from the intercom, only the rapid snarling of the dogs. Gabriel feared he had taken it too far too quickly. He reached for the intercom button again, but stopped himself when he saw the front door swing open and a woman step into the courtyard. She stood there a moment, black hair flying in the wind, arms folded beneath her breasts, then walked slowly across the courtyard and examined Gabriel through the bars of the gate. Satisfied, she looked down at the dogs and scolded them in rapid French. They stopped barking and trotted off, disappearing behind the villa. Then she reached into her coat pocket, produced the remote for the gate, and pressed it with her thumb. The gate slowly opened, and she gestured them to come inside. She served coffee and steamed milk in a rectangular sitting room with a terracotta floor and damask-covered furniture. The French doors rattled in the mistral. Several times Gabriel found himself looking at the doors to see if someone was trying to get in, but he saw only the elaborate garden writhing in the wind. Her name was Antonella Huber, an Italian woman married to a German businessman living in the south of France, a member of that itinerant class of European wealthy who are comfortable in many countries and many cultures. She was an attractive woman, mid-40s, with dark, shoulder-length hair and deeply tanned skin. Her eyes were nearly black and radiated intelligence. Her gaze was direct and without apprehension. Gabriel noticed the edges of her nails were soiled with clay. He glanced around the room and saw that it was decorated with ceramics. Antonella Huber was a skilled potter.
"I'm sorry about the dogs," she said. "My husband travels for his work, so I spend a great deal of time here alone. A crime is a major problem all along the Côte d'Azur. We were robbed a half dozen times before we bought the guard dogs. Lately we haven't had any problems."
"I can see why." She managed a brief smile. Gabriel used the lull in the small talk to come to the point. He leaned forward in his chair, elbows on his knees, and gave Antonella Huber a selective account of the events that had brought him here. He told her that his friend, the historian Benjamin Stern, had discovered that something unusual had taken place at the convent of the Sacred Heart in Brenzone during the war, the same convent where her mother had lived before renouncing her vows. He told her that his friend had been killed by someone who wanted that unusual event to remain a secret. He told her that her mother was not the only person to vanish without a trace in Italy. Two priests, Felici and Manzini, had disappeared around the same time. An Italian detective named Alessio Rossi believed the disappearances were linked, but he was ordered to close his investigation after Italian police came under pressure from a man named Carlo Casagrande, who worked for the Vatican Security Office. Antonella Huber remained motionless throughout Gabriel's presentation, her eyes locked on him, her hands folded across her knee. He had the distinct impression he was telling her nothing she did not already know or suspect. "Your mother didn't renounce her vows simply in order to marry, did she?" A long silence, then,
"No, she didn't.
Something happened at that convent, something that made her lose her faith and renounce her vows?"
"Yes, that's right."
"Did she discuss it with Benjamin Stern?"
I begged her not to, but she ignored my warning and spoke to him anyway.
What were you afraid of?
That she would be harmed, of course. And I was right, wasn't I?
Have you spoken to the Italian police?
If you know anything about Italian politics, you'd realize that the Italian police are not to be trusted in a matter like this. Wasn't Alessio Rossi, one of the men who was killed in Rome the night before last, a papal assassin?
She shook her head slowly.
My God, they'll do anything to protect their dirty little secret.
Do you know why they killed your mother?
She nodded and said,
Yes, I do. I know what happened in that convent. I know why my mother renounced her vows and her faith, and why she was killed for it.
Will you tell me?
It's probably better if I show you. She stood up. Please, wait here. I won't be a moment.
She left the room and walked upstairs. Gabriel sat back and closed his eyes. Chiara, seated next to him on the couch, reached out and laid her hand on his forearm. When Antonella Huber returned, she was holding a stack of yellowed writing paper.
My mother wrote this the night before she married my father, she said, holding up the papers for Gabriel and Chiara to see. She gave a copy of this to Benjamin Stern. This is the reason your friend was killed.
She sat down, placed the papers in her lap, and began to read aloud.
My name is Regina Carcassi, and I was born in Brunico, a mountain village near the Austrian border. I am the youngest of seven children, and the only girl. Therefore, it was almost preordained that I become a nun. In 1937, I took my vows and became a member of the Order of St. Ursula. I was sent to the Convent of the Sacred Heart, an Ursuline convent in the town of Brenzone on Lake Garda, and I took a position teaching in a local Catholic school for girls. I was 18 years old. I was very pleased with my assignment. The convent was a lovely place, an old castle located on the shores of the lake. When the war came, little about our life changed. Despite the shortages of food, we received shipments of supplies each month and always had enough to eat. Usually we had some left over to disperse among the needy in Brenzone. I continued my teaching duties and administered to the needs of those unfortunate souls affected by the fighting. One evening in March 1942, Mother Superior addressed us after our evening meal. She informed us that in 3 days' time, our convent was to be the site of an important meeting between Vatican authorities and a high-level delegation from Germany. The convent of the Sacred Heart had been chosen because of its isolation and the beauty of its facilities. She told us that we should all be very proud that such an important gathering should be held in our home, and we all were indeed pleased. Mother Superior told us that the topic of the meeting was an initiative by the Holy Father to bring about a speedy end to the war. We were instructed, however, not to speak a word about the meeting to anyone outside the convent. Even discussion amongst ourselves was forbidden. Needless to say, none of us slept much that night. We were all very excited about what the coming days would bring. Because I grew up so near the Austrian border, I spoke fluent German and knew about German food and customs. Mother Superior asked me to oversee the preparations for the conference, and I eagerly agreed. I was informed that the men would share a meal, then would adjourn to discuss the business at hand. In my opinion, our dining room was far too plain for such an occasion, so I decided that the meal and the conference should take place in our common room. It was a lovely room, with a large stone fireplace and the beautiful views of the lake and the Dolomites, a truly inspirational setting. Mother Superior agreed, and she permitted me to rearrange the furniture in the room as I saw fit. Dinner would be served at a large circular table next to one of the windows. For the meeting, a long rectangular table with a dark finish was set in front of the fireplace. I wanted everything to be perfect,
and when I was finished, the room looked quite beautiful indeed. I was thrilled by the prospect that my work might have some role in bringing about an end to all the death and destruction the war had wrought. The day before the meeting, a large shipment of food arrived. Hams and sausages, breads and pastas, tins of caviar, bottles of fine wine and champagne, things most of us had rarely seen in our lifetimes, and certainly not since the war had begun. The next day, with the help of two other sisters, I prepared a meal that I believed would suit the palates of the men from Rome and the visitors from Berlin. The delegates were scheduled to arrive at 6 in the evening, but it snowed heavily that day, and everyone was delayed. The men from the Vatican arrived first at 8:30. There were 3 in all. Bishop Sebastiano Lorenzi of the Vatican Secretariat of State, and his 2 young assistants, Father Felici and Father Manzini. Bishop Lorenzi inspected the room where the meeting was to take place. Then he led us to the chapel to celebrate Mass. Before leaving the chapel, he repeated Mother Superior's instruction that we never speak of the evening's events at the convent. He went on to say that anyone who violated his order would do so under pain of excommunication. It seemed a rather needless warning to me, for none of us would ever disobey a direct request from a senior Vatican official, but I knew that the men of the Roman Curia took their obedience to the rules of secrecy very seriously. The delegation from Germany did not arrive until nearly 10 o'clock. They, too, were 3. A driver who did not take part in the conference, an aide called Herr Beckmann, and the leader of the delegation, a man from the German Foreign Office named State Secretary Martin Luther. I would never forget that name. Imagine a man called Martin Luther visiting the Roman Catholic convent of the Sacred Heart in Brenzone. At the time, it was quite a shock. So was the State Secretary's appearance. He was a small, sickly-looking man with thick spectacles that distorted the shape of his eyes. He seemed to be suffering from a terrible cold, because he kept rubbing his nose with a white handkerchief. They immediately sat down to dinner. Herr Luther and Herr Beckmann commented on the beauty of the room, and I felt very proud of my accomplishment. I served the food and opened the first bottles of wine. It was a pleasant meal, and there was a good deal of laughter and camaraderie among the 5 men seated at the table. I had the impression that Herr Luther and Bishop Lorenzi were well acquainted. Apparently, Mother Superior had neglected to tell them that I was from Brunico in the far north, because they spoke freely in German whenever I was in the room, surely out of the mistaken impression that I did not understand the language. I heard much interesting gossip about the affairs in Berlin. The conference began at midnight. In Italian, Bishop Lorenzi said to me, "We have much work to do, sister. Please keep the coffee coming. If you see an empty cup, fill it." By now, all the other sisters had gone to bed. I sat outside the common room in the antechamber. After a few moments, our young kitchen boy appeared, dressed in pajamas. He was an orphan who lived in the convent. The sisters nicknamed him Cicciotto, little chubby one. The child had been awakened by nightmares. I invited him to sit with me. To help calm him, we recited the rosary. The first time I entered the room, it became clear to me that the men were not discussing a negotiated settlement to the war. State Secretary Luther was in the process of handing around a memorandum to the other 4 men. As I poured coffee, I was able to see it quite well. It had 2 columns, and the columns were divided by a vertical line. On the left were the names of countries and territories, on the right were figures. At the bottom of the page was a tally. Herr Luther was saying, "The program to bring about the final solution to the Jewish question in Europe is well underway. The document you have before you was presented to me at a conference in Berlin in January. As you can see, by our careful estimate, there are 11 million Jews in Europe at the moment. That estimate includes territory controlled by the Reich and its allies, and in countries that remain neutral or allied with the enemy. Herr Luther paused and looked at Bishop Lorenzi. Does the girl speak German? No, no, Herr Luther. She is a poor girl from the Garda region. Her only language is Italian, and even that she speaks like a peasant. You may speak freely in front of her. I turned and left the room, pretending not to have heard the terribly insulting things the prelate had just said about me to the German. My face must have shown my embarrassment, because when I entered the antechamber, Cicchiotto said, "Is something wrong, Sister Regina?" "No, no, I'm fine, just a little tired." Shall we continue to say the rosary, sister? You say it, my child, but softly, please. The boy resumed the rosary, but after a few moments he fell asleep with his head resting on my lap. I cracked the door a few inches so I could hear what was being said inside the common room. Herr Luther was still speaking. This is what I heard that night, recorded to the best of my recollection and ability. Despite our best efforts to keep the evacuations secret, word, unfortunately, is beginning to trickle out. It is my understanding from our own ambassador to the Vatican that some of these reports are beginning to reach the ears of the Holy Father. Bishop Lorenzi replied, "That is indeed the case, State Secretary Luther. I'm afraid the news of the evacuations has indeed reached the Vatican. The British and Americans are putting enormous pressure on the Holy Father to speak out." May I speak bluntly, Bishop Lorenzi? That was the point of this gathering, was it not? This program, to settle the Jewish question once and for all, is underway, the machinery is in place, and there is nothing His Holiness can do to stop it. The only thing he can do is make matters worse for the Jews, and I know that is the last thing the Holy Father wishes to do. That is correct, Herr Luther, but how would a protest make matters worse for the Jews? It is imperative that the roundups and deportations go smoothly, and with a minimum of struggle and histrionics. The element of surprise is a critical factor. If the Holy Father issues a protest, accompanied by an explicit warning about what deportation to the East truly means for the Jews, then it will make the roundups messy and difficult affairs. It will also mean that many Jews will go into hiding and escape our forces. One cannot argue with the logic of that statement, Herr Luther. At this point, I felt it was time for me to offer the delegates more coffee. I eased the boy's head off my lap, then knocked on the door and waited for Bishop Lorenzi to invite me to enter the room. "More coffee, Your Grace? Please, Sister Regina." There was a pause in the conversation while I refilled their cups and exited the room. Then Herr Luther resumed. Once again, I left the door ajar so that I could hear what was being said. "There is another reason why it is critical that the Holy Father not raise his voice in protest. Many of those who assist us in this necessary endeavor happen to be good Roman Catholics. If the Pope condemns their behavior or threatens them with excommunication, it might make them think twice about the work that they are doing. You may rest assured, Herr Luther, that the last thing the Holy Father would do is excommunicate Roman Catholics at a time like this. I wouldn't presume to give the Church advice on how to run its affairs, but there are reasons why papal silence on this matter would be best for all involved, including the Holy See. I'd be interested to hear your learned opinion, Herr Luther. Look at that figure I have laid before you. Imagine 11 million Jews, a figure almost beyond comprehension. We are dealing with them as quickly and efficiently as possible, but it is a difficult task we have set for the Reich. What would happen if, God forbid, Germany should lose this war to Stalin and his gang of Jewish Bolsheviks? Try to imagine what would happen if there were millions of displaced Jews in Europe at the end of the war, alive and dispossessed, clamoring for the right to emigrate to Palestine. The Zionists and their friends in Washington and London would have their day. It would be impossible to prevent the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Jewish control of Nazareth, Jewish control of Bethlehem, Jewish control of Jerusalem, Jewish control of all the holy sites. If they have their own state, they would have the right, as the Vatican does, to send their diplomats around the world. Judaism, the ancient enemy of the Church, would be placed on a footing equal to that of the Holy See. The Jewish state would become a platform for global Jewish domination. That would be a true disaster for the Roman Catholic Church, a setback of unimaginable proportions, and it looms just over the horizon, unless we complete the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe. There was a long silence. I could not see inside, but in my mind I tried to picture the scene. Bishop Lorenzi, I imagined, was fuming at so grotesque and monstrous a speech. He was preparing, in my imagination, to shatter the man from Berlin with a ringing condemnation of the Nazis and their war against the Jews. Instead, this is what I heard through the half-open door that night. As you know, Herr Luther, we members of Crux Vera have been very supportive of National Socialism and its crusade against the Bolsheviks. We have worked very quietly yet diligently to align the policies of the Vatican to meet our common goal, a world free of the Bolshevik menace. I cannot instruct the Pope what to say about this situation. I can only offer him my heartfelt advice in the strongest possible terms and hope that he accepts it. I can tell you this. At the moment, he is predisposed to say nothing about this matter. He believes a protest will only make the situation of German Catholics more tenuous. Furthermore, he has no love for the Jews, and he believes that in many respects they have brought this calamity upon themselves. Your thoughts on the future situation in Palestine give me a potent new weapon in my arsenal. I'm sure His Holiness will be very interested to hear about this, but at the same time, I beg of you to proceed in such a manner that you will not unintentionally force his hand. The Holy See would not want to be obliged to utter a word of disapproval. Obviously, I am very pleased to hear your remarks, Bishop Lorenzi. You have proven once again that you are a true friend of the German people and a trusted ally in our fight against Bolshevism and the Jews. And fortunately for you, Herr Luther, there is another true friend of the German people inside the Vatican, a man who outranks me significantly. He will listen to what I have to say. As for myself, I will be glad to be rid of them. I believe a toast is in order. As do I. Sister Regina! I entered the room. My legs were trembling. Bring us a bottle of champagne, the bishop said to me in Italian, then added, No, sister, make that two bottles. Tonight is a night for celebration. A moment later, I returned with the two bottles. One of them exploded when I opened it, and champagne spilled onto the floor and my habit. I told you she was a peasant girl, the bishop said. She must have shaken it on the way. The others had a good laugh at my expense, and once again I had to smile and pretend as though I had not understood. I poured out the champagne and turned to leave, but Bishop Lorenzi took my arm. Why don't you join us in a glass, Sister Regina? No, I couldn't, Your Grace. It wouldn't be proper. Nonsense. Then he turned to Herr Luther and, in German, asked whether it would be all right if I had a glass of champagne after all my hard work, preparing the meal. Ja, ja, shouted Herr Luther. Indeed, I insist. And so I stood there, in my stained habit, and I drank their champagne. And I pretended not to understand when they congratulated themselves on a very successful evening of work. And as they were leaving,
I shook hands with the murderer named Luther and kissed the proffered ring of his accomplice, Bishop Lorenzi. I can still taste the bitterness on my lips. In my own room, I painstakingly transcribed the conversation I had just overheard. Then I lay awake in my bed until dawn. It was a night of perfect agony. I am writing this now on an evening in September, in the year 1947. It is the eve of my wedding day, a day I never wanted. I am about to marry a man who I am fond of, but whom I do not truly love. I am doing it because it is easier this way. How can I tell them the real reason I am leaving? Who would believe such a story? I have no plans to tell anyone about that night, no plans to show anyone this document. It is a document of shame. The deaths of 6 million weigh heavily upon my conscience. I had knowledge, and I kept silent. Some nights they come to me with their emaciated bodies and ragged prison clothing, and they ask me why I did not speak up in their defense. I do not have an acceptable answer. I was just a simple nun from the north of Italy. They were the most powerful people in the world. What could I have done? What could any of us have done? Chiara stumbled into the powder room. A moment later, Gabriel could hear her being violently sick into the toilet. Antonella Huber sat silently, her eyes blank and damp, staring out the French doors at the garden which was twisting in the wind. Gabriel stared at the pages in her lap, at the careful, precise script of Sister Regina Carcassi. It had been a torturous thing to hear, but at the same time he was overwhelmed by a swell of pride. An amazing document, those few yellowed pages. It dovetailed perfectly with things he had learned independently already. Had not Licio, the old man from the convent, told him about Sister Regina and Luther? Had not Alessio Rossi told him about the mysterious disappearances of two priests from the Germany desk of the Secretariat of State, Monsignors Felici and Manzini? Did not Sister Regina Carcassi place those same two priests at the side of Bishop Sebastiano Lorenzi, official of the Secretariat of State, member of Crux Vera, friend of Germany? And fortunately for you, Herr Luther, there is another true friend of the German people inside the Vatican, a man who outranks me significantly. Here was an explanation of the inexplicable. Why had Pius XII remained silent in the face of the greatest case of mass murder in history? Was it because Martin Luther convinced an influential member of the Secretariat of State, a member of the secret order known as Crux Vera, that a papal condemnation of the Holocaust would ultimately lead to the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine and Jewish control of Christian holy sites? If so, it explained why Crux Vera was so desperate to keep the meeting at Brenzone a secret, for it linked the order, and by extension the church itself, to the murders of 6 million Jews in Europe. Chiara came out of the bathroom, her eyes damp and raw, and sat down next to Gabriel. Antonella Huber turned her gaze from the garden, and her dark eyes settled on Chiara's face. "You are Jewish, yes?" Chiara nodded and lifted her chin. "I am from Venice." "There was a terrible roundup in Venice, wasn't there? While my mother was safe behind the walls of the convent of the Sacred Heart, the Nazis and their friends were hunting down the Jews of Venice." She turned from Chiara and looked at Gabriel. "And what about you?" "My family came from Germany." He said nothing more. There was nothing else to be said. "Could my mother have done something to help them?" She looked out the French doors once more. "Am I guilty too? Do I bear my mother's original sin?" "I don't believe in collective guilt," Gabriel said. "As for your mother, there was nothing she could have done. Even if she had defied the orders of the bishop and leaked word of the meeting at Brenzone, nothing would have changed. Herr Luther was right. The machinery was in place. The killing had begun.
and nothing but the defeat of Nazi Germany was going to stop it. Besides, no one would have believed her.
Maybe no one will believe her now.
It's a devastating document.
It's a death sentence, she said. They'll just dismiss it as a forgery. They'll say you're out to destroy the church. That's what they do. That's what they always do.
I have enough corroborating evidence to make it impossible for them to dismiss it as a hoax. Your mother may have been powerless to do anything in 1942, but she's not powerless any longer. Let me have this, the one she wrote with her own hand. It's important that I have the original. You may have it on one condition, and that is that you destroy the people who murdered my mother. Gabriel held out his hand.
This book is continued on Disc 7.